Let me share with you three things that you should probably know about on this day. So NATO says, fight on. Mark Rutte, the organization's talking head, wants to ramp up the war in Ukraine. Why? Here's another why. Why does NATO need the war? And is it really a defensive organization bent on defending democracy, as they say? Or is NATO an aggressor? Is it offensive instead? We are going to give you the facts on this. Also, a U.S. State Department whistleblower is telling Tucker Carlson who's really running U.S. foreign policy. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. All right. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to begin with a reality check. So, I don't know if you know this or not, but you should know this. Russia is the largest country in the entire world, by far. Also, has more natural resources than any country, by far. Therefore, you should then ask yourself this question. Why in the world would Russia want or need more land, right? Now, we can also look at it this way. Poland, France, Denmark, Germany, all of these countries have soaring inflation, high, super high taxes, runaway homelessness, and they're overrun with immigrants, right? Those are headaches that nobody wants, including the people in those countries, and obviously including Russia. You know, this thing where these countries, these small countries, think Russia wants them, Russia doesn't want you. It's like the not-so-attractive guy or gal, remember back in high school, who goes around telling everybody, everybody wants to go out with me, everybody wants to go out with me, I'm so cool. No, they don't. They don't. I mean, that is why this guy, NATO's Mark Rutte, sounds like just like that, like somebody in high school. Right? As he turns some non-story about some runaway drones in Poland into, quote, Russia's plan to take over Europe. It's crazy. But here, listen to him in his own words.
Allies are resolved to defend every inch of Allied territory. We will closely monitor the situation along our eastern flank, our air defenses continually at the ready. This only reinforces the importance of NATO and the path to which allies agreed at our summit in The Hague earlier this year. We need to invest more in our defense, ramp up defense production, so we have what we need to deter and defend. And we need to continue to support Ukraine, whose security is interlinked with our own.
Ramp up the defenses. More, more, more war. And of course, Ukraine is interlinked with Europe. Look, those words are obviously intended to make Russia out to be an aggressor nation. And NATO, of course, is a peaceful defender of freedom and democracy. But any fair and careful examination of the facts tells a very different story. If NATO is so peaceful, then what do you call this? The bombing of Iraq under false pretenses, killing more than 500,000 civilians. How defensive is that? Please explain it to me. How about this? A 20-year war with Afghanistan. Who in Europe needed to be defended from Afghanistan? Like Afghanistan was going to attack Europe? And then there's Belgrade, this beautiful and historic city in Serbia. NATO bombed them for three straight months. A city in Europe, killing, according to the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., I know I used to visit that center, as many as 2,000 civilians in Belgrade. And what is the new peace plan for NATO now, according to Mr. Rutte? A continuation of the war in Ukraine. A war, by the way, that even President Trump says was started by NATO, along with Presidents Biden and Obama. But NATO's Ukraine problem has an even bigger problem. Now, here it is. Russia is winning the war in Ukraine, and not by a little bit, by a lot. So wouldn't you think then, if that's the case, right, that Rutte and NATO would be better off just cutting its losses? Ixay Nixay saying, you know what? This ain't looking so good, right? Why continue? Why escalate? Why try and make it even a bigger war, a longer-lasting war, which is obviously what he just said he wants to do? Here's respected independent analyst, Professor John Mearsheimer, calling what Ruta is saying essentially a denial of reality.
What are people in the West going to do? What are people like Mark Ruta going to do? You want to remember that they're so heavily invested in this war at this point, and they're continuing to double down, that you're now in a situation where if the West loses, if NATO loses, this will be a devastating blow. And are they just going to accept that fact? Are they just going to say, well, the Russians won. We gave it our best shot. It didn't work out, and we have to swallow this bitter pill. Is that likely to happen? I don't think so. I think the pressure to escalate in the West and to double down further if the Ukrainian forces begin to crumble will be enormous. And we will be in a very dangerous situation.
Dangerous situation. You know that famous Pottery Barn store rule? I love this thing. Look, if you break it, you own it. If you break it, you own it, right? Well, when all is said and done, history will show, I believe, NATO broke Ukraine. And conversely now, let's look at it this way. Not saying it's going to happen, but I'm saying it's a possibility. Ukraine could end up breaking NATO. Let's focus now on the United States. What's their place in all of this? Place where President Trump, it seems, is keen to NATO's big problems. He understands them, including its problem in Ukraine, which is why he's constant. You hear him say this all the time, constantly reminding everyone who will listen to him that almost seems sometimes as I listen to him say this, that he's actually trying to convince historians that this is not his war. Ukraine is not my war, he keeps saying. However, to be fair, while Mr. Trump attempts to verbally separate himself from the disastrous decisions made in connection to Ukraine by NATO and others, his actions belie his statements. Right? For example, what happened to the Donald Trump who promised this that I'm about to show you? This, remember this? This is his much-heralded Saudi Arabia speech.
In the end, the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. They told you how to do it, but they had no idea how to do it themselves. When I left office, the only thing still standing between this region and its unbelievable potential was a small group of rogue actors and violent thugs seeking constantly to drag the Middle East backward and into havoc, mayhem, and indeed into war. The West should not be dragging itself backward into another endless war in Europe, yet another endless war. We should stop the killing and work together to address the biggest long-term threats as one unbeatable team. As President of the United States, my preference will always be for peace and partnership whenever those outcomes can be achieved.
Interventionists, rogue actors, endless wars. Sounds like he's talking about what NATO did in Ukraine. Sounds like he's talking about what Israel is doing in the Middle East. I mean, what Mr. Trump said in this speech, specifically implying he would stand up to these interventionists and profiteers, rogue actors, was epic. I mean, I cheered when I heard that. Yes, right? Yay. Would he actually be the first president since John F. Kennedy to take on the deep state? So far? No. Uh-uh. Not even close. As Mr. Trump's presidency has played out, his actions vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Gaza, China, even Ukraine, they've not even come close to resembling his promises. And now we're beginning to understand why. In this revealing interview on the Tucker Carlson podcast, a State Department official turned whistleblower explains who the real puppet masters are who have turned America first into, quote, America last.
I've said this to, you know, anyone who will listen, I think this will end the Republican Party. I don't think they're going to get elected to anything anytime soon after this if they don't pull back and establish independence from this Israel or any other foreign power. It's not about Israel. It's about any letting any other foreign country run your country. That's, you can't have that. Everyone hates it. It's super unpopular and it's very obvious.
On one end, it's the America first aspect that's very disappointing because this is America last in every possible way. And on the endless war front, every campaign, every winning presidential candidate said, we're not going to get, we're trying to avoid these wars, and they don't follow through.
Shahid Gureshi is that guy's name. He worked at the State Department. They fired him. He's telling Carlson that, look, when it comes to foreign policy, the people in charge there at the State Department are hawks and neocons from the Heritage Foundation working inside the State Department. And when it comes to its policy in Israel, right, U.S. policy in Israel, nothing comes out of Washington, he says. All the decisions are being made by Zionists in Israel who clearly run the show and tell the White House and the State Department what to do.
He would go up, he would go either laterally or up the chain and call various people and say, hey, Ambassador Huckabee, you'll cite Huckabee usually, and say, wants this done or in for XYZ reason. And if that person didn't pick up, it would go to the next person.
Did you ever see David Milstein, like, thinking about what's good for the United States or getting aggressive on behalf of what our interests might be as distinct from Israel's interests?
I perceived a lot of his actions as very Israel first.
So is really a lot of this, you think, based on your experience, was coming from this one guy?
Correct.
And you know what this guy's final act of betrayal was, I guess? Qureshi's final act of betrayal? What got him fired? He wrote in a State Department memo after Israel targeted and killed, ruthlessly, five journalists from Al Jazeera. This guy wrote in a memo that condolences should be offered to the families of those dead journalists. That's it. That was his sin. Apparently, Israel didn't like that.
I drafted a line, a few lines. And by the way, there were not some softy lines. The only thing that was there that they didn't like was I did share condolences, which is pretty standard policy.
Condolences? What do you mean?
So I said, we share condolences for the families of the killed journalists. That's all.
Well, that sounds like hate speech to me.
Yeah.
Condolences to the families of people who got killed.
Yeah.
Non-combatants killed in war.
Yep.
That comment, by the way, leads us perfectly into our next segment. If you're a regular viewer, you saw when I was sparring recently with my guest from Israel. I give him props for showing up. But I told him flat out that his country, Israel, had absolutely no right to bomb a sovereign country again. Not the first time they've done it. But to bomb a sovereign country simply because you don't like the people that are visiting with them, their guests? I was referring, of course, to the recent bombing of Doha, Qatar. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Rashid Amohanadi. He's a Qatari fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs to find out what is the latest on this situation. The obvious question is, do we know yet really who was in on this? Don't go away. We'll be right back. The story is really still developing, and I've got a comment now I'm going to be able to share with you. You see, Arab and Muslim leaders have been gathering in Qatar for an urgent summit. And they're there because, well, they're angry. And as one would expect that they would be angry, right? They're angry, and they're responding to this unbelievable Israeli strike on Doha. I still am shaking my head trying to understand. The Emir of Qatar, who usually doesn't come out, he usually has let his prime minister make the comments, has come out with a statement regarding what he calls unfathomable, that Israel would systematically assassinate politicians whom it has called to negotiate with. So I think we have that comment now. Before we start my interview with Mr. Mohanadi, I want to play it for you so he can hear it as well and react to it. Gene, if you have it, let's go ahead and play this now.
The citizens of this safe country were surprised and the whole world was shocked, not only because this aggression is a dangerous violation of a state's sovereignty and a trampling violation of international conventions and norms, but also because of the special circumstances surrounding this cowardly terrorist act. Qatar, which is thousands of miles away from the place from which the aircraft were launched, is a mediating state that's been making efforts for 2 years to achieve a balance that stops the destructive war which attacks the Palestinian people in Gaza, which has been turned into a war of extermination. When this treacherous attack took place on September the 9th, the political leadership of Hamas was considering an American proposal that it received from us and from the Egyptians. And it's clear that Israel, which is supposed to be the other negotiating party, at least in the context of this negotiation, which was being held in a well-known location frequented by diplomats, journalists, and others, it decided to assassinate negotiators who were studying an American paper to prepare their response to it. Have you heard of something like this before? A state that systematically and persistently assassinates politicians with whom it negotiates and attacks a mediating country in which the negotiations take place.
A state that consistently assassinates people with whom it is negotiating with. He asks, have you ever heard of anything like this before? It seems to me the emir is quite angry. And I think this meeting has some significance, especially for the Gulf states, who have really been amongst the most in that part of the world in trying to break the friction, if it will. I've almost tried to bend over backward to help both Israel and the United States in trying to foster better relationships. It almost seems like a stab in the back, if anything, but I'm going to let my guest use his words to describe this. Rashid Al-Mohammadi is a resident fellow, Middle East Council for Global Affairs. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thank you, sir, for joining us. What do you think of the comments by the emir?
Well, I think not only the emir is angry, the entire region is fuming with what happened. An equivalent would be if the U.S. decided to assassinate the Taliban negotiation team during the U.S.-Taliban mediation that occurred in Doha. That succeeded in ending the U.S. longest war in its history. That would be the only equivalent, which is just ludicrous.
There's another case I could give you, only because it comes to mind as I'm hearing you say that. About a month ago, there was an Israeli official who went to Las Vegas. Have you heard about this? While he was in Las Vegas, he was caught by the FBI trying to have sex with a 15-year-old girl. He's an Israeli official. He was there for a conference, a computer conference. He was apprehended. An Israeli official who works in the Nevada state government got him out. They put him on a plane and flew him back to Israel. It would be, I would say, as if the United States would bomb tomorrow Tel Aviv and say, you have somebody there who's a criminal, who committed a criminal act in our country. We want him back, and we're going to kill him while he's on your soil. Why not? Isn't that the precedent that's been set? In that case, I would actually agree with it more.
That would be a good analogy. You don't go bombing other states because they're hosting a side you opposed to in a mediation you asked for. It is just ridiculous what happened last week. It's not ridiculous. It's criminal.
Did you ever...
It's terror.
Did you ever... Pardon me. I thought you were finished. I apologize. Did you even... did anyone in Qatar think, comprehend, imagine that something like this could happen? After all, there is precedent for it. They had done something similar in Lebanon and had done something similar in Syria. And the other one doesn't come to mind, but I can think of at least three or four cases where they have done this before.
Those cases, even though I don't agree with them, were against combatants during a war. There is some military value to these strikes. What happened in Doha was attacking the mediation platform and attacking the negotiation party, while I might remind everybody that there are still Israeli hostages within Gaza that have not been freed. And this potential deal that was being negotiated would have helped in that. And, you know, my discussions with policymakers here in Qatar are saying that this was potentially a break, a deal that would provide a breakthrough in the hostage situation.
I understand. I was looking this up today. There were four or five people killed, and one of them was a Qatari. It was a colonel in your military who was killed by these Israeli missiles. I didn't know that before. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. They killed one of your citizens.
Well, yes, we had one martyr, Bader al-Dosri. He was part of the internal security forces, which we call Lahwiya. Uh-huh. They are in charge of protecting diplomatic missions. Bader, you know, may God bless his soul, was actually one of the police officers protecting the U.S. embassy at some time. So it's an unfortunate loss what happened. And, you know, I send my condolences through you know, your platform to his family. And the condolences to the entire people.
Thank you, sir. Understandable. It was just a guy who was trying to do his job, and he was thinking he was protected by the auspices, right? Say again?
He was 22.
Wow.
He did not even live his life.
And he assumed...
And I don't want to share too much detail, but the only way he was been able to be identified was through what was left of his body.
Wow. That says something about the impact itself. I'm just wondering what can come out of this summit, for example. What do you think the response should be for Israel? As I mentioned, you may have heard me a little while ago, I had a conversation with one of Mr. Netanyahu's dear friends and officials, former IDF intel guy, just a couple of days ago, and he did not have very good things to say about the Qataris. He had horrible things to say about Qatar and thought that essentially when I questioned him and told him that it was wrong to do what he did, he said that you guys deserved it. What's the response to someone who says something like that? And what should be the response to Israel?
Well, unfortunately, Netanyahu himself and many of his friends have become morally broke and politically broke. They are trying, and this is, you know, my assessment, it's short-termism for the gain of political survival. And we see this through the statements and the narrative that's trying to be pushed, equating what happened to the assassination of Osama bin Laden. You know, yani you are either uninformed or you're stupid if you'd believe in this comparison. And it's silly. Honestly, it's silly, but it shows that the Israeli establishment, at least this is what I believe, were not involved in such a decision. And when you understand the Israeli military establishment, this decision could only come from one person, which is the prime minister.
You think that maybe it was Smoltrick, for example, and others who are part of his war cabinet who are just... described by even some people in Israel who I know and my other friends in the United States who are very pro-Israel, they say to me these people are crazy. Do you think it was that little cabal that actually was able to pull this off without it being the will of the Israeli people?
Of course not. Of course not. It's against Israeli national interest what happened. Qatar was a conduit for Israel, even though we don't have official diplomatic ties, for them to negotiate with Hamas and get their hostages out and potentially negotiate a ceasefire. May I remind you that also Qatar was instrumental in negotiating a ceasefire between Israel and Iran during their 12-day war. So it's against Israeli national interest. Number two, there are some reports that even the Mossad were either against or not informed with this attack. And it makes sense because the Mossad has a vested interest in normalizing with Gulf states. And bombing a Gulf state does not help, you know, this Israeli national interest to be achieved. So I think it's just political short-termism.
In fact, I mean, if we really want to get down to brass tacks here, you know, many of the Gulf states, including Qatar, were part of the Abraham Accords. They literally have bent over backward to try and create conditions where Israel can be part of the fabric of the Middle East, and have actually even tried to mend fences between Israel and other Arab countries. I mean, you've done a lot to try and help Israel. Do you feel like they have stabbed you in the back?
So to answer your last question first, of course, we feel stabbed in the back. But Qatar was not part of the Abraham Accords. From the Gulf, it was just the UAE and Bahrain. But let me, you know, shed some light on Qatar-Israeli relations. Qatar was the first Gulf state to somewhat normalize relations with Israel in 1998 when we opened a representation office here in Doha, very close to my think tank's office. It was only closed after the Israelis refused to stop bombing Beirut in 2006. So Qatar actually, you know, pushed a lot, and we got bashed in the media and, you know, through any other Arab states for what we've done.
Thank you for the correction, by the way. I thought that they were part of it. I'm sure in spirit they were, judging from everything I've read and as you just explained. I'll tell you one where it's certainly for sure that Qatar has a very good relation with the United States of America, very good relation with the Trump administration. You have a military base there that has 10,000 U.S. troops on it. You guys pay the bill for that military base. You recently gave Mr. Trump a $450 million plane. I mean, talk about bending over backward to try and do everything possible to have good relations with the United States. You would think that after all of that, you would have at least gotten a phone call from Washington saying, hey, you know, duck, heads up, something's coming, right? I don't think that phone call came.
It came 10 minutes after the explosions. We started hearing the explosions. That's when it happened. So you're correct. You know, Qatar has a very long and strong relationship with the U.S. that, you know, materialized after the invasion of Kuwait. And when the U.S. wanted to move CENTCOM somewhere else, and, it, you know, Qatar offered to, you know, host the CENTCOM front command in Al Udeid Air Base, which is a Qatari base, by the way. It hosts the CENTCOM front command and some allied forces. Unfortunately, you know, my assessment is that rather than complicity, the Trump administration was made a fool of by the Israeli government. They might have given them very ambiguous, you know, reporting saying, oh, we might target a Hamas operative in the, somewhere in the region. And the response would be, oh, cool, you know, go ahead with that. And that would might be the case. And because what happened is totally against U.S. national interest, because if U.S. loses its credibility as a security guarantor, this does not only affect U.S. relation with Arab states. It affects Taiwan. It affects Japan. It affects South Korea.
But
it affects all U.S. allies.
But here's the problem. They just did this. The United States and Bibi Netanyahu, you know, yin and yang here, they just did this exact thing in Iran. They told Iran, we're going to be negotiating a peace deal. Don't worry about it. No one's going to attack you. You're good for the next 24, 78 hours. You're good until Sunday night. And then they attacked on Friday night or Saturday morning, whatever it was. So exact same thing they did to you. They did, right? Say again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, so it was one day before the negotiation when Iran and I see the analogies. The only difference is this mediation, it was sponsored by the U.S. and by Egypt. So the U.S. was a beneficiary to this discussion. When in the Iran-Israel conflict, you know, the 12-day war, it might be a little different because it was an actual war. You know, we even received a volley of 20 ballistic missiles, which we intercepted 19 of. One, unfortunately, went through. And then we utilized that after being attacked to broker the peace deal.
Yeah.
So yeah. Qatar has proven that it's, not because I'm Qatari, but that it's proven that it's a state that always pushes for peace, yeah, even if we are being attacked.
Yeah. No, you listen, you've got a reputation for that, being the moderates in the region, always trying to put different sides together. I mean, that's been what Qatar has been doing for a long period of time. The question is, should your leadership have trusted that you can have a relationship or even a conversation with the United States without assuming that Bibi Netanyahu is really in the room?
Well, you know, the U.S. has the burden of rebuilding trust now, not only with Qatar, but with all, you know, its GCC allies. You know, just to illuminate something, Qatar has been designated a major non-NATO ally, which is the highest designation in the U.S. And, you know, additional major non-NATO allies are Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan. And he just signed a comprehensive defense agreement with the UAE. So if these designations, if these treaties have no meaning and no value, then I think a big reassessment has to happen, not on just Qatar's level, but regionally.
Well,
when it comes to regional security architectures.
Look, I'm American and I love America and I'm proud to be American, but I worry, like I have been reporting, that the folks running the foreign policy in America don't love America like I love America, because their decisions that are making are not good for Americans, just like the decisions I think Bibi Netanyahu is making are not good for Israelis. In fact, I don't think they're good for Jews in general anywhere in the world. So I don't criticize for the sake of criticizing. I criticize because of what you just said. If you're constantly breaking deals, if you're constantly signing treaties and not upholding them, if you're constantly saying, we're going to have a conversation and figure this out, and then the people in the conversation get bombed, and this happens repeatedly, at some point, no one's going to come to your well anymore. No one's going to visit you. No one's going to trust you. No one's going to like you. No one's going to believe in you. This is my concern for my country.
And it's true, you know, because America, from a Gulf perspective, America helped us liberate Kuwait. Mm-hmm. America helped us counterbalance some regional threats. And that's why the states of the Gulf have been very open in investing, buying American kit, hosting American troops. So what's happening now is, honestly, American national interest being hijacked because of the domestic political issues of another state.
I don't know if you heard this. I was just doing my intro, as I often do before I introduced you, and I was watching my friend Tucker do a story night before last where he interviewed a whistleblower inside of the U.S. State Department who was fired. He was fired apparently because, I don't know, Bibi Netanyahu wanted him fired or NATO wanted him fired. I don't know. But he was fired essentially for telling the truth, for in many ways defending things that should be defended. He says he wrote a memo offering condolences to the five journalists, the Al Jazeera journalists who were targeted and killed by Israel. And just for offering condolences to their families is one of the reasons they used to fire him. What's your reaction to that?
I saw the show. You know, I watch Tucker a lot. And it wasn't a surprise seeing that a low-level embassy employee in West Jerusalem dictating what statements come out of the State Department.
Yeah.
But it's a question that, honestly, it's a question the Americans have to ask, because us in the region, we are very resilient, Sanchez. We are very resilient. Mm-hmm. And we're not shaken with what happened, and we will continue doing what we do best, which is building peace in the region. But, now it's a question to the Americans. Do you want to be part of this? Or, many analysts would say that the U.S. is going into the stage of isolationism. You know, they're staying in their hemisphere and they don't really care about what's happening outside their hemisphere. But I need to remind everybody the global order as it is now, or what's left of it, has been built in the interest of the U.S. by the U.S. And some countries were beneficiary to this, you know, mainly smaller states like ours. But, you know, the world will go on. The world will continue.
It's interesting. Basically, based on what you just said, I'm just thinking to myself, I see a change. I'm sure you've read, I just returned from Beijing, and I was there covering the summit that was held there, the cooperative summit. And I got a sense while I was there that, I hate using the word New World Order because everybody uses that and it sounds trite. So I got a sense that the Global South community, the BRICS community, whatever the hell we want to call it, this new enterprise has never been stronger, has never been prouder, has never been more united than it is right now. And when I compare those countries and the GDP growth and 6.8% in places like India, 5%, China, even 3.8% in Russia, I know Qatar has relationships with Russia from a fuel and energy standpoint, et cetera. It almost seems to me it makes more sense for countries to start leaning in that direction than it is to lean in the direction of some of these old colonial countries in Europe, for example, that have zillions of problems and no GDP growth and lots of crime and lots of high taxes, et cetera. I could go on and on. Do you see that shift?
Well, you know, the writing is on the wall. I was in Beijing earlier this year speaking at an event, and I said, you know, we have to, everything follows the money. Most of the world's GDP is generated in the Global South. Most of the world's people are in the Global South, so both the generators and the consumers. So it's a natural shift of the center of gravity towards the East and Southeast. So it's inevitable. Hmm. But what the West can do is they can reintegrate themselves and redesign the relationship with the Global South in a way that is mutually beneficial. But unfortunately, history tells us that that is not the case. You know, when somebody rises and somebody goes down, there is always conflict.
Yeah.
So, you know, my assessment is, unfortunately, we might be seeing more conflict.
Well, you know, we have an expression in America. It's a very famous expression, and it goes like this. You've probably heard it. You're very worldly. It says, when you're in a ditch, stop digging. And that's it. I mean, it's like I'm watching you, the Europeans. They want to continue fighting the war in Ukraine. It's like you're losing. Stop. But they're like, no. We have to keep digging. We have to, and the more you dig, the further down you go. And I don't understand it. And I know you can't speak for the United States or for the Europeans, but you could speak for Qatar. I imagine countries like Qatar and other countries in that part of the world we'll probably start either looking to align or aligning themselves with this new power source in the world. No.
Well, I wouldn't say align. I would say you know coordinate, synergize, develop relations with. So Qatar already has really good relations with the Global South. Qatar is an advocate of South-South cooperation through hosting different forums, conferences, participating and funding different forums and conferences in the Global South. Most of our economic relationship is with countries in the Global South. You know, our main commodity is liquefied natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that's going east. Most of that's going east. So it's only natural. But in the end, Qatar, like I said, is a peace-loving nation. We will focus on building peace. We will try to balance. We like to balance that stuff. You know, we're the world's mediator of choice. We mediated in Latin America. We mediated in Africa. We're mediating in Europe. We facilitated the reunion of Russian and Ukrainian children that were displaced during the war.
Mm-hmm.
Through our embassies in Europe and in Moscow. So in the end, Qatar will always play this middle role. But the fact of the matter is, most of the economic clout of the world is going towards the global south. It's already there.
What happens if the United States tries to do to you what it tried to do to India, for example, and say, if you're friends with Russia, we're going to cut you off and increase your tariffs? What if the United States or some other Western country came and told Qatar, you're not allowed to be friends with China. You're not allowed to be friends with Russia. You're not allowed to be friends with so-and-so. And if you are, we're not going to be your friends anymore, which is almost like it sounds like something high school, but that's kind of what's going on. What would Qatar's reaction be?
So first of all, I hope we wouldn't reach that case, that level of you have to choose. But, you know, I have to remind my friends in the West that it's not a zero-sum game. It's, you know, both can benefit. We have our security arrangements with the West, with the U.S. And if that is sustained and we can, you know, still trust the credibility of those guarantees, we can still have an economic relation with China. If you tell the people you have a choice, they will make an economically informed choice.
Yeah. No, you have a relationship with Rosneft, one of the biggest companies in Russia as well, because you share some of the same principles in the oil industry and in the natural gas industry. It's like the Indians say, we've got 1.4 or 5 billion people who need energy. We're going to make decisions based on what they need, not what some political decision happens to be. And I think that makes all the sense in the world. Let's finish up with two more questions, I guess. I know we've taken up a lot of your time, and you've been so kind and so generous, and you're such an affable person and such a good speaker. First of all, this summit, what do you think can come of this summit?
So it's important for us to not look at the summit as a singular event. It's part of a wider initiative to, you know, rally around peace-loving nations and nations of the region towards putting pressure on the current radical government in Israel. It started with the Security Council statement last week, which we saw very strong statements from everybody speaking except the Israeli. We saw strong statements from the Russian representative. Mm-hmm. And we also saw the U.S. condemning the Israeli action, without naming names, but condemning the action at least. So that's one thing. Second is the summit today. It shows Qatar's diplomatic power in being able to rally all of these world leaders at a very short notice. You know, you're talking about 3 or 4 days of preparation, flying everybody to Doha. The weather is still a bit warm, but I hope they enjoyed their time. But what's more important than the statement is the discussions. We'll have face-to-face discussions between the leaders of the region. Hmm. Then we can see something material happening. And I'd like to also remind all of us that we have coming very soon the New York Declaration, which passed with a landslide vote. Only 22 countries either rejected or abstained from voting, which shows that the majority of the global community is for the establishment of a Palestinian state and for the Arab Peace Initiative. And, you know, this is a historical moment for Israel. The Arabs are coming with a solution. Arab states are not state threats for Israel. And this is their chance to, you know, reach a negotiated deal.
You know, some people would say you guys are just too nice. Everything you're saying seems conciliatory. But listen, I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. So I believe in the Prince of Peace. And Jesus Christ said that no matter what happens in your life or in your world, you should always turn the other cheek. And you guys are literally living that by example. So
We believe in Jesus. You know, as Muslims, we believe that Jesus is a prophet. And peace. We put peace above everything else. But we also like to, you know, pressure bullies to stop bullying.
So let's finish with the bully. That's the place I wanted to end the conversation with. I'm hearing all kinds of things about people predicting what's going to happen with Israel. If they continue down this path, it's not good for them. I cannot see how the world can continue to accept somebody doing what they're doing. I don't have to be specific, but I could show you the pictures. I could show you the reports one after another, essentially saying that this is an extermination campaign. This is a genocide. And we've seen what is actually going on. And who knows when the final tally comes in, what the numbers will actually be. So how do you think the situation will end for Israel? And maybe parting last words from you would be, if you could have a conversation tomorrow with Mr. Netanyahu, what would you tell him?
Of course. So first of all, the policies of Israel now are leading to Israel's isolation. I think the only reason Arab states haven't like cut ties, the normalizer, is that there is still some glimmer of hope that we can reach a negotiated deal. It's not just political isolation, it's also economic isolation. Israel is a small state.
Yeah.
Israel is not very resource rich. Israel is an export economy. Most of their exports go to Europe and then to the region. And if they become isolated, it's bad for the Israeli people. And some parting words before we end this. If I could speak to Netanyahu, I would say, think of how this region will look like for your grandchildren with the policy decisions you're taking.
Yeah, I think that's the reason that should move all of us as human beings. It's for our, fellow citizens. And most of all, I always say this, one of the reasons I do what I do for a living, one of the reasons I consider myself a truth teller, or as close as I can come, although I'm imperfect, is I always think of my children and my grandchildren. And I think that's why we should do things. I'm not sure that's his motivation, but I'm not here to judge, and neither are you, but we can only hope. Rashid Al-Mohanadi, is such a pleasure talking to you. I look forward to sharing some tea with you at some point in Doha.
Whenever you're here, I'll be happy to host you.
Thank you so much. God bless. Take care. Wow, what an interesting conversation. Well, there you have it. That's the reaction from Qatar regarding what's going on. Conciliatory, obviously, to say the least, perhaps more than most of us would expect, given the situation they're in and what they just suffered at the hands of the IDF and the Israeli government. Nonetheless, it is what it is. As you know, I have a podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking. We will put parts of this on there with my commentary as well. All you got to do to find that is go to JSpeak or Journalistically Speaking. It's on YouTube. And, of course, we will also have cuts on X. And you can find those at Rick Sanchez TV, also with my commentary. What a pleasure. Thank you for letting us into your home. We'll see you next time.